You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Welcome, everyone, to the RSA. I'm Matthew Taylor, Chief Executive. I'm delighted you've joined us for this special lunchtime talk. Particularly delighted because I can guarantee that you will leave the room feeling personally challenged as well as intellectually stimulated. So you've set yourself up for some cognitive dissonance at the end of this session, or alternatively, to change your life. Now, it's my great pleasure to introduce this afternoon's special guest speaker, Peter Singer. Peter is Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University and Laureate Professor in the School of Historical and Philosophical Studies at the University of Melbourne. He is, as I'm sure you know, the most prominent ethicist of our time. He's the author of more than 20 books, including Animal Liberation, Practical Ethics, and The Life You Can Save. He joins us today to discuss a provocative new movement in which his own ideas have played a crucial role. That movement is effective altruism. We are absolutely delighted and honoured to have you here with us today, Peter. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Peter Singer.
Thank you very much for that warm welcome, and it's a pleasure to be here. Again, my second time at the RSA. I was last here about 6 years ago. Talking about my previous book, The Life You Can Save, and what I'm talking about today is related to that theme, but goes beyond it in various ways. So, the title of the new book is The Most Good You Can Do, and the subtitle is Effective Altruism. So, Effective Altruism is an emerging movement and a philosophy in the sense of an approach to life, that is a way in which some people are thinking about how they want to live their lives. And I think that's what Matt was referring to when he said that the ideas in this book are challenging, I hope, to each one of you, because we all ought to reflect on how we're living our lives and can we live them in a way that is better than what we're doing now. So what is this philosophy of effective altruism? Essentially, it's the idea that we should act so as to make the world a better place, but not just a slightly better place, but rather we should use whatever resources or abilities we have to do the most good that we can within that restriction of what we are able to do. And in order to decide what is going to do the most good that we can, we need to draw on evidence that is available and find more evidence where relevant that will enable us to see how some choices might do more good than other choices. And so there is, if you like, an altruistic element of this, that is a concern to do good, which very often, though I don't know whether in absolutely all cases, but very often anyway, has a kind of an emotional basis, desire to see fewer people suffering, to reduce the amount of suffering that happens in the world, for example, but also a cognitive basis. You have to use your thinking and reasoning to find out how to do that. Effective altruism is the name also not just of this philosophical approach to how you want to live your life, but also the name of an emerging movement, particularly of younger people, particularly of people who have come of age since 2000, so the generation we call the millennials, but certainly not only of that. And some of the people I know in the movement are more like my age, and they've got involved and see it often as a way of reconnecting to values that perhaps they held earlier in their life, but which in pursuing their career and having families and all those other things, they may have somewhat lost touch with and want to reconnect with that again. So this is a movement which has been developing in just really within the last decade. In fact, so if you put effective altruism into Google now, you'll find quite a lot of websites. You find, for example, a Wikipedia page on it. You find effectivealtruism.org, Center for Effective Altruism. None of these you would have found if you'd Googled that 5 years ago. They're all really quite new. Quite a lot of the drive for this movement, which is very much an international movement now, actually does come out of England, originally out of Oxford. I think one of the first intimations that I had that something really new was happening in this area was when I was, at the time when I was working on my previous book on the life you can save, about 2007, I was contacted by a graduate student in philosophy at Oxford called Toby Ord, who told me that he was interested in setting up an organisation called Giving What We Can to encourage people to think more about how they can give effectively. And he had come to this himself because he had been, he was a graduate student, and he felt he was living reasonably comfortably on his graduate studentship, which is not a lot of money. I think at the time it might have been £14,000 a year. Probably inflation has taken them up a bit since then. But he felt that this was actually quite adequate. He was meeting all of his basic needs, and wasn't that he was just scraping by. He even was able to travel across to France over the summer vacation and things like that. And he realised that given that he was doing well and he was quite likely to get an academic job once he got his PhD, that over his lifetime, his income would be increasing well beyond this. But he thought, do I really need to increase my expenditure well beyond this? Maybe I'll increase a little bit, but do I really need to just let my expenditure rise as my income rises? Or are there other good things that I could do with the amount of money that I would have? And if so, what might they be? So he did an interesting calculation. He looked at academic salaries, plotted a kind of imaginary career for himself. I don't know the details, but, rising through the ranks and perhaps eventually becoming a professor at some point, looking at the salaries and saying, now suppose that I just continue to live more or less on my graduate studentship amount of money, how much extra money would I have during my lifetime that I would have to do something else with? And then having got to that sum, which as you could imagine is quite a large sum, he then said, well, what can you do that would, for instance, make people better off, reduce the amount of suffering, particularly, if you focus on where can you find the things that are most cost-effective, where you do the most good. And he concluded, and I think most people who looked at this concluded, that you get better value for your money if you help people in developing countries than if you help people in affluent countries, partly because their incomes are much lower, so you make a bigger difference to their income. So if somebody is in extreme poverty by the World Bank standards in a developing country, they're living on not much more than a pound a day, really, in current terms. Whereas, of course, if you're looking at people who are below the poverty line in Britain, I'm not sure exactly what it is. I know in the United States, for a family of four, I think it's around $23,000, so maybe it's something equivalent to that. It's a lot more. And so it takes a lot more money to make an equivalent difference to somebody who is poor in Britain as compared to somebody who is poor in a developing country. And as an example of the kind of thing that you can do, that again, you can't really do in Britain, you could find a person who is blind because they have cataracts, which have never been treated because they live in a country with no national health service and they're too poor or in too remote an area to pay a doctor to remove them. Now, basically that doesn't happen here in Britain. If you get to the point where you are really blind because of cataracts, a doctor will say to you, well, you should have come to me earlier, even once your vision was getting seriously affected, we could have got these removed at no charge to you. And the cost of removing cataracts in developing countries, there are somewhat varying estimates, but I think you could pretty safely say it's not going to cost you more than, let's say, £50 per person whose sight has been restored, if you want to be conservative in your estimates, you might double that. But anyway, these are fairly modest sums by what we're talking about. And Toby's calculations meant that with the amount of money that he was talking about, he calculated that he could restore sight for 80,000 people. So you imagine, you know, Wembley filled with a big crowd or something. It's something like that number of people whose sight you could restore. And this is just one person on a reasonably ordinary amount of income. This is not anybody who's been fabulously successful and become an extremely wealthy person. So that was what got Toby started in this idea that, firstly, more people ought to know about this, because if more people know about how inexpensively you can make a really important difference to somebody, maybe more people will see that as something that you can do. He also thought that we should set some kind of standard to encourage people to give, and the organisation Giving What We Can actually invites people to pledge to give 10% of their income to organisations that are highly effective in reducing suffering and doing things of that sort. So the fact that Toby was doing this, and he himself actually took a public pledge to live on an amount which was roughly corresponding to his graduate studentship, just a little bit more, and adjusted for inflation over the years. And that's what he's been doing. So he has been giving very substantial amounts to these causes. Now, that was one instance of an early organisation in this field that was trying to encourage people to think about these issues. There have been others. There are now effective altruism groups in many different countries, in the United States, in Australia, in Europe. There are groups in Switzerland and Germany and Poland and Czech Republic and a whole range of different countries that have people working on this. So it is a movement that is getting more people to think about these kinds of issues. There are a lot of questions that it raises, clearly. One of them might be, well, how do you decide what is the best thing to improve the world? I've given you one example that seems like an inexpensive way to help people. Is that the best thing to do? How do you make those comparisons? So the example I've given you is not life-saving, but it is clearly life-improving. I think we really all agree that if you're blind, then restoring your sight is going to improve your life. How do we compare that with an organisation that is distributing bed nets against malaria in countries where malaria is still a major killer of small children? There's an organisation called the Against Malaria Foundation that does it very transparently in terms of its cost, and can be shown to be saving lives, not at 50 or 100 pounds. According to one organisation that's assessed them, it's something like $3,000 per life saved. So it costs a lot more, if that estimate is right, to save a life than it does to restore someone's sight. But maybe saving a life is more important than restoring someone's sight. We need to have some ways of thinking about that, and we need to have ways of assessing the charities that do it. Then another comparison that is perhaps even more difficult relates to things that I've written about over the years. I've been concerned to argue that we give too little consideration to the suffering of non-human animals, that we ought not to be treating them in the way we do, and the largest form, I think, of suffering we inflict on non-human animals is by confining them in factory farms, which gives them miserable lives for not just like the pain of being slaughtered or of being transported, which are relatively brief, but you know, we're talking about, in the case of battery hens, say, we're talking about an entire year in a small wire cage. In the case of other breeding sows, for instance, they may also be confined for years during this period. So we're talking about prolonged suffering, but then you might say, well, we're trying to compare the suffering of a pig or a hen to the suffering of a human being, maybe the suffering of a child who gets malaria or of parents who have to watch their child die from malaria. So that's an extremely difficult kind of question. How do we compare animal suffering with human suffering. And I don't know whether anybody has a really good answer to that. People take different views. So there are effective altruists who focus on the suffering of non-human animals, and there are some who focus on the suffering of human beings as well. Then there are further questions about, for instance, things that are harder to measure. So there are organisations now that are trying to measure the cost of doing the good things that I've mentioned. I've given you a couple examples, and the website of Giving What We Can, givingwhatwecan.org, is one of those that does that. An American organisation called GiveWell does that, and an organisation that grew out of my previous book that's called The Life You Can Save, thelifeyoucansave.org, also has a website that tries to make those sorts of comparisons between different organisations and the amount of good that they're doing. What about things like that are not actually measurable in quite the same way? So organisations that act as advocates for the poor, that try to change government policies to relate to the poor. I mean, you've the United Kingdom, to its, I think, great credit, has recently achieved the goal of giving 0.7% of gross domestic product to foreign aid. I shouldn't say that that's, you know, necessarily a stopping place. There are a handful of countries that give more than that, but it's certainly considerably better than the UK used to give a few years ago, and it's considerably better than the United States is giving today. That's a good thing that happened. It didn't just happen. It happened because there were citizens lobbying the government to say this should be a goal. This should be a bipartisan political goal, in fact. And that is what was adopted. So that's a very large sum of money as compared to anything that any individual can give. That increase in UK aid has been a very large sum of money that is now going, I think, with reasonably high effectiveness, because I think well of DFID and the way it distributes aid. So it's hard to compare effectiveness of government programs with NGOs. Generally, I think NGOs are more efficient, but still, given the sum, I think this is a very important goal to have been achieved. Would have been hard to predict in setting out that you would achieve that goal or how much it would raise. So that's something else that's very hard to assess the impact of, an advocacy role for organisations that are not doing something measurable, like saying, OK, we've spent this much money, we've distributed this many nets, we've followed up on infant mortality in the region, and we see that it's fallen as compared to other regions where we did not distribute nets, so therefore we know we've saved X lives at a cost of Y pounds. But you can't really do that with advocacy because you don't know, at least in advance, whether it's going to pay off or not. That seems to have been a case that's paid off very well. Many other advocacy campaigns don't pay off at all. I mean, attempts to change European Union trade policies so that they are more favourable to developing countries, so that small farmers in developing countries can sell their agricultural products on global markets without having to compete with subsidised products from the EU or, for that matter, from the United States. Those have not been so successful as yet. So it's sometimes very difficult to make these estimates, but I do think that they're the kinds of questions that we need to be asking. So I think that effective altruism is an important movement, and I think it has the potential to transform the way we think about philanthropy. Generally speaking, people have a positive view of philanthropy, but it tends to be a kind of emotional warm glow feeling than something that is really based on good knowledge of the data of what you're achieving. And there are studies of who gives to charities and what do they give and how much research do they do before they decide on their gifts. And the answer to the last question is, for the majority of people, zero. Most people do not do anything that could even remotely count as research before giving to a charity. It's more like a matter of receiving a glossy leaflet or seeing a TV ad that has an image that you like and deciding to give, or hearing that there's a humanitarian catastrophe in Nepal or in Haiti or in the Philippines and saying, I'll give to that, and not really thinking about, is this the best thing to do with my resources? How does it compare with other things that I might do? And as I say, the majority on all of these surveys do say they do admit they do no research. The minority that do some research tend to do very superficial research. They tend to be worried that the organisation that they're giving to is basically a fraud. So they may look at the amount of the proportion of revenue that goes to administration and fundraising. And of course, if you do look at that and you find that 80 or 90% goes to administration or fundraising, then basically the organisation is a fraud and you shouldn't give to it. But that's very rare. And I doubt that the organisations that you would be thinking of giving to would be anywhere near that kind of category. So once you avoid that, and you're talking about, well, one charity, maybe 10% of its revenue goes to administration and fundraising, and another charity, maybe 30% of its revenue goes to administration and fundraising. Does that mean that the charity where only 10% goes to administration and fundraising is going to give you better value for your money than the other one? Well, the answer to that is no, not necessarily. That information just doesn't really tell you anything that is really relevant to what good do the programs do. Right? You may know that 90% of the revenue goes to programs in Charity A and only 70% in Charity B. But maybe that's because Charity A cut back its staff so hard that it no longer really monitors or evaluates the effectiveness of the programs that it's funding. It just pushes out the money and hopes that those programs are going to do well. Whereas Charity B does keep good staff who travel to places where the programs are being implemented, looks at what they do, says in some case, yes, this is a good program, we should continue to fund it. Another place says, no, this is not achieving what we wanted, we should not fund it any further. And therefore, maybe, you know, the 70% actually does a lot more good with Charity B than the 90% does with Charity A. So you really need to think about those sorts of questions if you want to be an effective altruist. So what I've done so far is just sort of briefly introduce you to the ideas of effective altruism, to the ideas of thinking about how can you do the most good. I know that we're going to have plenty of time for questions and discussion, so I'll look forward to hearing from you. Thank you very much.
Okay, that's great, Peter. I think you're kind of letting us off a little bit lightly, really, with your examples of altruism. Tell us about Zell Kravinsky.
Okay, so Zell Kravinsky is actually a bit of an exception to what I was talking about. As I said, most of these effective altruists are relatively young. Zell is closer to my age, anyway. And I read about Zell in an article in The New Yorker called The Gift, a little bit before effective altruism had really got going. He was a bit of an isolated case. But Zell was somebody, he lived in a suburb of Philadelphia. He clearly had a gift for calculating returns on investments, although that was by no means his only interest. He actually had a PhD in literature, having studied Milton. But he then started making some real estate investments that had done very well and had accumulated about $45 million. When he decided that really he didn't need this money and he should give most of it away. So he put aside small amounts for his children. But, you know, when I'm sort of out of $45 million, maybe a million or so, and gave the rest away. But he then decided that this really wasn't good enough. He learnt that there are people on waiting lists for kidneys in the United States waiting to get a donated kidney, who are dying because dialysis isn't really working for them or whose quality of life is very bad. So he went to a hospital in downtown Philadelphia, an area that serves mostly African Americans, and told them he wanted to donate a kidney to whoever was next on their waiting list and couldn't get one. At first, they sort of basically told him to, you know, take a deep breath and go away. But he came back to them, and they put him through various psychological testing, and he turned out to be completely sane. In the end, they did accept his donation, and there is a went to an African American woman who had a markedly improved life, and Zell is, this is now 11 years ago, Zell is doing pretty fine on one kidney, as most people do who donate a kidney. This is actually interesting, although, as I say, Zell was such an outlier that the hospital did all these tests, and it is now something that is other people are starting to do, and I've got other examples of younger people in my book. I think in Britain it only became actually legal a few years ago, but already there are more than 100 people who've donated kidneys to strangers in Britain. So
Zell did this on the basis of a calculation about the likelihood of harm occurring to him as a consequence of the...
Yeah, that's right. He read studies about how likely is it if you donate a kidney that you will die earlier because of that. Because, you know, of course you may get kidney disease, but kidney disease typically will affect both kidneys. So the fact that you donated one isn't going to help you there. So it's quite rare that you get something that that actually is just going to affect one kidney. And Zell's calculation, or a study he read, said there was only a 1 in 4,000 chance that your life will be shortened by the fact that you've donated a kidney. And he thought, as I said, he's a kind of mathematically inclined person, he thought, well, if I don't give a kidney, I'm placing a value on my own life that's 4,000 times higher than the value I'm placing on the life of whoever that person who would receive my kidney is. And he thought that was just very compelling logic, and did it. And Zell, because Philadelphia is not very far from Princeton, where I teach, I've had him come and talk to my classes a few times now, and he puts that kind of argument, and I can see the students often find it unsettling. I don't know that any of my students has actually donated a kidney, but I have been in contact with, as I say, a few other people who have because of ethical considerations like this.
So this discomfort that your students felt is not surprising, is it really? I don't think this is a concept which appears in the book, but the concept of cognitive dissonance kept occurring to me as I was reading the book, which is the idea that we suffer discomfort if that which we believe abuts against what we do, and we therefore have to adjust either our beliefs or our behaviours to overcome cognitive dissonance. Now, your book creates cognitive dissonance because when you read your book, you really feel that you ought to start giving away a lot more money, not just a little bit more money, but a lot more money. And this goes down, as you say, to people who are not rich themselves. Mm. Do you find that the book and these ideas more broadly generate a kind of visceral response from people, that it's not simply intellectual objection that people have to you, but also they, in a sense, feel personally threatened by the fact that you're making them feel uncomfortable about the way they live their life?
There's certainly some of that reaction. I think there's a wide range of reactions that I get to the book. There are some people who basically say, I've been an effective altruist all my life. I didn't know there was a word for it. So they feel reinforced because they actually have been thinking about how to do good with their lives for quite a long time. And often they thought they were a bit of an oddball because, you know, they wonder why the other people that they know don't think like this. It seems to them very normal. But then, as you say, there are a lot of people who, for whom this is much more of a challenge, who felt that they were ethical people but were not really doing anything to help people outside their immediate circles or their local community. And so they do feel challenged, and sometimes there's pushback. There's also clearly pushback from people who support charities, but they're not charities that come within the range of the ones that I'm discussing, that I think are doing the most good.
So you use the word effective. I'm interested in whether you think, on a psychological level, that your argument is an effective argument, in the sense that, arguably, if you'd come along here and said, look, there's absolutely no reason why you shouldn't all give 5% of your income if you're above average. It's completely, it made virtually no difference to your life, and why don't you do that? And here's a universal target we can all aspire to. Instead, Your book is full of examples like Zelle, which the assumption is, in a sense, you can always do more. You can always go further. It'll never be enough, which can lead people to feel a sense of entirely self-serving despair about the whole thing, which is, well, that Peter Singer, doesn't matter what, I can give my kidney away, I can give my money away, I can give everything away, you'll still want me to do more, so I may as well just carry on as I'm sweetly doing at the moment. So is effective altruism an effective psychological tool?
Well, it's a really interesting question, and that question does get discussed within the effective altruism movement. As I mentioned, the organisation that Toby Ord set up, Giving What We Can, asks people to pledge 10%, and you know, if you pledge 10%, you become one of their members, and so on. And yet Toby himself has pledged significantly more than that, because he's rather pledged to stay within on a certain base, and whatever else he earns, he'll give. So the same question can be asked there. But I don't think I could have just come up here and said, well, everyone should give 5%, because you know, this is not an unintelligent audience. People would have said, why 5% exactly? And you know, you need to give some answer to that. So my view is that I don't think we should worry too much about exactly what level, whether it's 5%, 10%, 25% or more. I don't think we should worry too much about that. And if you're giving anywhere in any of those ranges, you're doing very well by the standards of most people in Britain, most people in affluent countries. So if you say, well, I think I could manage 5%, I'd say, great, start at 5%. You're doing really well. See how you enjoy it. After a year, maybe you want to review that. And you might want to say, last year I gave 5%. This year I could give 7% or 10%.
But doesn't that pragmatism, Peter, fly in the face of your utilitarian argument, your quasi-utilitarian argument, your appeal to reason? Because in a sense, wouldn't you, as a philosopher, then say to me, if I was giving 5%, say to me, well, you know, once you've given 5%, once you've accepted the principle that other people matter as much as you do, well, then there's no logical reason at all to stick at 5%. So doesn't your philosophical perspective drive you towards, eventually, a Zelle Kravinsky?
I mean, in one sense it does, but as you said, it's a utilitarian position, and therefore what I really want to do is to maximise the total that is given to effective causes. So, you know, you have just argued that I'd be more effective if I urged that people give 5% rather than if I talked about Zelle Kravinsky. So I think I can therefore say, look, in terms of what we want to say to general audiences in this room or out there watching the stream, you know, what we want to say is do something and think from there how much you ought to go to. And I'm certainly not going to be critical of people who are far above the standard in their community, even if they're not above what I might call the ideal utilitarian standard, which is what you're referring to. I don't think we need to focus only on the standard of what we would all do if we were all 100% altruistic, because there are very few humans who are 100% altruistic, if any. I'm not sure. Maybe, you know, Zelle might be one of the closest examples you can come across. You know, I'm certainly not going to condemn people for not donating a kidney, because I still have 2 kidneys myself, so I would be hypocritical if I were to do that. I don't consider myself a sort of a saint that everybody else ought to follow either.
Sticking to this issue of reason, you talk about David Hume in the book, and you address the argument that is made as a critique of your position, which is that, as it were, we're not driven by reason, we're driven by emotion, and emotion leads us naturally to favour our loved ones rather than strangers, for example. I'm interested in that notion, but I wonder whether part of the reason that Hume argued that it should be, not just is, but should be emotions rather than reason that drive us, is also related to his own theory of knowledge and the unknowability of the world. That is to say, how do we know that altruism ultimately is good for the world? There is another theory, which would be if we were all entirely self-interested, that would be the best thing for the world. There'd be another theory that would say if we all looked after our loved ones, that would eventually be what was best for the world. 1 billion people have been raised from poverty in the last 15 years, which is the biggest reduction in poverty in the world that humanity has ever seen. Very little of that was to do with altruism. So how do we know that altruism is good for the world? Isn't that just a hunch?
Well, I mean, effective altruism is very information-driven. And if the evidence comes in that promoting altruism is not good for the world, then effective altruists will stop promoting altruism. So I think, you know, you need to examine those claims that have been made.
So what about a very broad claim, then, about dependency? What about a very broad claim that would say, when you give money to aid, it's an argument that's often made about the welfare state in Britain, that when you help people out, in the end what you do is you infantilise them, you make them dependent, and that actually cuts against their interests, because what they really need to do is be self-reliant.
Well, I mean, there are differences in situations in a society that is reasonably affluent and situations in societies that are very poor and where there are very few opportunities. But, you know, I think you need to think about that critique of aid, and you need to find ways of doing aid which does not make people dependent. And, you know, the sort of charities that are recommended on the websites that I mentioned are aware of that question. So, for instance, you know, they will distribute bed nets, but distributing bed nets I don't think makes people dependent, because there's all sorts of other things apart from bed nets that people want, and they're still going to be motivated to go out and get it. There's one charity that actually gives cash. It's called Give Directly, but it's very aware of this dependency issue, and it finds very poor families currently working in East Africa, and it tells them that it will give them a total of the equivalent of $1,000 in three installments over about a year, typically, I think it's done, and that's it. They will never get any more money from this particular charity. So it's saying, we're going to give you a sort of chance to get yourself to a different situation, to improve things in various ways, and from there you're on your own. And then it also, it's another very transparent organisation. It monitors what people spend that money on, and whether they're better off or not better off a year or two down the track. So I think you've got to look at the information in order to decide whether this dependency critique is true or not, and you've got to be more specific about the types of aid that may or may not create dependency.
Okay, final question for me before I open it up, and I wouldn't ask this anybody else, but you are a philosopher, so I'm allowed to ask big questions like this. There's a kind of sense in your book that you're hedging your bets, that there's one argument here, which is this is how you should live your life. You should live your life approaching as far as possible the idea that you are a good citizen. You know, the goodness should be the goal of your life. Then there's another argument that sort of reason should be the goal. You should be guided by reason. And there's another argument, which is that actually if you are altruistic, it makes you feel good about yourself. So this is a kind of notion of fulfillment. Yep. I'm kind of interested, what is your underlying story of what life is for, what a human life is for in this regard?
Well, you have to be careful asking what a human life is for, right? Because, you know, if somebody says, well, what is a glass for? We say, well, it's to hold liquids in particular. And, you know, we've designed it to hold liquids, and that's why this glass was put out here, because someone anticipated that I might want some liquid while I was talking and put out a suitable container for it. But, you know, I don't believe that we were designed in that sense. I don't believe that there was a purpose to the universe that set out to create human beings for some goal that he or she or it had preconceived. I accept the evolutionary story of how we ended up where we are today. So if people say, well, what is human life for? I would say it's for each one of us to choose what our own life is for. But the values that I hold, which I do think can be given a foundation in reason, but that's a longer story. The values that I hold are such that I hope that people will decide that their lives are at least in part for making the world a better place. And the part about finding that fulfilling and satisfying and so on is a kind of a way of answering people who might then say, look, you know, tell me why I should do this, and, you know, don't. I could try and go into the stories of why I think this is the right ethical view, but I couldn't also go into the story of why I think actually it won't really be a sacrifice to you as an individual anyway, because the meaning and fulfillment that you get out of knowing that you're making the world a better place, will more than compensate you for the fall in material standard of living that you might have if you give significantly.
Thank you. Okay, so let's take this hand that shot up here, this person wanting to donate his kidney already.
Hi, Patrick Foster. I run a volunteer mentoring organisation at Women's Grubs Prison. I was interested in lots of things. I could go through the word definition of good, etc., but I won't. I was absolutely amazed by your concentration on the word cash. There seemed to be some sort of view that if you gave more cash, that was better than someone who didn't give as much cash. And you could define a volunteer as someone who's giving, who's 100% altruistic, because they're giving, they have no income, and they're giving their time voluntarily. Firstly, I haven't read the book, therefore I don't know whether you cover it, but how would you value volunteering? Because you didn't mention the word or anything that came anywhere near volunteering.
Okay, let's take two or three together, Peter.
Okay, my name's Shuna Kennedy. I've done interim directorships with a range of charities. And it's a huge field, as you know. And I'm thinking, what about, I mean, the examples you have are fundraisers, dream charities, give a net, give whatever. What about the difficult ones that are trying for strategic change? So I'm thinking particularly international aid in violence against women. So trying to stop child marriages, trying to stop FGM, trying to stop direct violence against women. I'm thinking of a UK charity called Bail for Immigration Detainees, about the appalling way that we treat our immigrants. You're saying overseas is more effective. So, I think there's an emotion in there as well.
Okay, and then third, over there.
I'm Get Your Share on Twitter. Your solution makes no attempt to understand world politics. Mark Goldring, the head of Oxfam, said charities will never solve problems because the problems are too big and getting bigger all the time. All poverty is manufactured. Therefore, dismantling the institutions that make poverty is the only solution, which can only be done through politics. Does your solution not protect the world elite and churches while making everyone else pay for their horrors upon the world? Thank you very much.
Nice, easy questions for you there, Peter. So basically, your strategy is avoiding kind of issues of power and oppression and all of that, and just it's a sticking past the solution. What about you did talk about advocacy, but you might remind people the argument about advocacy organisations. And then what about time as being as important as money?
So I think, I think I did use the word resources, at least when I started talking about people being altruistic. That is that they should use the resources that they have, and clearly time is a resource as well as money. Probably true that generally I talk about money more than I talk about volunteering. But for some people, clearly, volunteering, you know, they have more time, they have little money. That may be a better thing for them to do. One of the problems with volunteering, though, is, you know, I do think that, generally speaking, it's more effective to be doing things that help people in developing countries. You know, your volunteering program that you mentioned is clearly helping people in the UK. That's a good thing to do, and it's excellent that people who don't have much money should be doing that. If you are trying to help people in developing countries, often there aren't equivalent volunteering opportunities. You might be able to intern at an organisation that is doing that, but I can see, you know, there's problems of actually using the time really effectively. The next question was about advocacy organisations, and particularly ones that are advocating for women against child marriage or FGM or something of that sort. I think, you know, as I said with advocacy, it is harder to assess. It's definitely not so easy to assess, and that I used the example of increasing the UK aid budget. I think similar questions can be asked about that. That is, so how much is it taking in the way of resources, and what is the return on it? How successful is it in preventing child marriages? How successful is it in preventing female genital mutilation? Those are questions that need to be answered. Now, you may have data on these specific things, and if so, they may show that it's highly effective. But I think we still need to have some of that data.
But how would you test something like that? Because an idea is ineffective until it reaches a certain tipping point when it becomes effective. So it's totally ineffective and then it's totally effective. There's no, which is different to bed nets, where there's a kind of ratio of effectiveness.
Mm-hmm.
So how would you calculate the effectiveness of a piece of advocacy?
You can look at track records. So I give a couple of examples in the book. Again, they are related to foreign aid sorts of things, but I talk about Oxfam's campaign to get Ghana to set aside some of its oil revenue. Ghana recently discovered some offshore oil, to help some of the poorest farmers in the country, so that unlike other African countries like Angola and Equatorial Guinea, the money doesn't go just to line the pockets of the elite, but actually goes to some of the poorest in the country. So I talked about a campaign there that was highly cost-effective, you know, a rather small amount of money that Oxfam used to support local Ghanaian civil society organisations, that achieved a significant payoff. Now, you could say, well, if Oxfam does that here, then even if 9 out of 10 of their advocacy campaigns are not successful, that every now and again a big lottery win would pay for the other ones. You have to try and look at that. With female genital mutilation, I imagine you've got a number of countries, a number of areas in which this is happening. Organisations have been working on it for some time. Are they effectively reducing it? Have they got wins in some countries? I mean, that's the sort of information that you need to
have.
And
what about the idea that you're an apologist for the global capitalist order?
You know, look, I think it's easy to say that. It's much harder to spell out the strategy of how you're going to transform the global
economic order. Put your hand
down. That's what we need to have here. We need to have some idea of how you're going to do it. So what I'm talking about, in a sense, is a Band-Aid to an underlying problem. But don't you ever use a Band-Aid? I mean, sometimes you can't stop the bleeding. And if you can't stop the bleeding, it's good to use a Band-Aid. So sometimes we can't change the global economic order. Either we don't know what would be a better one, or if we do have an idea about what would be a better one, we don't know how to get it implemented, given the current power structure. So we can still help individual families. We can still help people see again. We can save kids' lives. We can, perhaps prevent violence against women. All of those things are good things to do.
And then, gentlemen here.
My name's James. I'm an LSE philosophy student and a member of Giving What We Can. So I had a question about how you decide between two charities when you're not really sure about what the effects will be. So, say in one case, you were looking at SCI, where the evidence is quite strong. But then another charity, such as Deworm the World, where the evidence is slightly weaker, but does point towards it being more effective. Do you think there's a reason to just go for the more effective one in kind of expected probability, or the kind of the one where there might be more evidence, but the evidence points to a kind of slightly lower level of effectiveness?
Thank you for your talk. A couple of weeks ago, Matthieu Ricard, a Buddhist monk, was here, and he was asked a question about prioritising action in a world which needs so much action. And his answer was, work on self-compassion. And it reflects an argument in a book recently out called The Fearless Heart, which is about the effect of compassion on the brain and how it actually changes our lives from the inside. Now, a lot of what you said is about how you connect brain and wallet. And I'd like to build on the idea of volunteerism. If we work more on compassion, heart through to the hand, you get a different quality of reaction to all the problems that we have around us, rather than not simply, but aiming for a qualitative and quantitative approach to giving to organisations, which we could be spending all our time trying to reach this best answer and actually neglecting those around us whilst we do it.
Very good question.
I've got your book, so I'm beginning to read it, but I was puzzled by this. You seem to be optimizing the return of your investment from a cash point of view. Now, if on the other example would be, if I want to pay all my credit cards, yes, I would pay primarily all the money that I have towards the more expensive car. That's a very simplex optimization problem. It's a simplex method. It's a shadow price. By reduction to the absurd, if I have a charity in Africa that is extremely effective, I should donate zero to every single other charity in the world. Now, I believe that there is a greater good in giving some amount of money to charities that are not necessarily capital intensive. They are charities that are people intensive. They are charities that save the way that people communicate, that save people from committing suicide, that save people from doing genital mutilation. So why are we saying that we need to optimize just from a financial point of view, as opposed to optimizing the output of the good, which is a composition of giving some critical mass to millions of charities that have many more millions of volunteers behind them? So why not diversity?
Okay, so let's link, Peter, the first and the third question. So the first question was around kind of how do you decide it, to an extent can you kind of go with a charity which might not be as effective now, but it might be in the future, and this view about what about a kind of balanced portfolio of giving rather than this kind of very technocratic approach of giving it all to the one that's most effective. And then in the middle of that, what about the notion of kind of personal compassion and connection?
Compassion and Matthew Ricard, yes. So I think the answer to the first and third actually is the same, really, in a very abstract sense, and that is that I do think you ought to maximise expected value. Now, in terms of the point about evidence, expected value is the value that you will achieve if you're successful, discounted by the odds against your achieving it. And the question was about some cases where you might have strong evidence that charity A is effective to a significant extent and weak evidence about charity B, but the evidence points to it being more highly effective. So, I mean, it really is the strength of the evidence could be regarded as the degree of confidence that you can have that your donation will achieve the goal. And then it depends on how much greater the goal is and how great the degree of confidence is as to whether you should do it. So, you know, we have a kind of deficit of the really hard information there, and therefore I can't give you a definite answer between the two charities you mentioned. But I can, you know, as a philosopher, I can give you the theory, I guess, and say if you can plug in the facts, then the answer will fall out. With regard to your point, I think you're suggesting that there are other values that are achieved by diversifying your donations. And the question is whether that's true or not. So if you take into account those goods, then you might say these goods add to the value. So let's suppose I have this one charity, which, as you say, is the most effective in terms of, let's say, saves lives for the lowest cost. And then these other charities that you think donating to will achieve various other goods in helping perhaps them to get established in their communities, to do good, to attract further people to work for them, and so on. So you might then say, well, they're going to have kind of multiplying effects. If I give some smaller amounts to those charities, that'll have multiplying effects, which will lead to other future returns. It, like with that question, it becomes more speculative. But if the facts are the way you're suggesting, then sure, you can diversify because the diversification itself produces some benefits. I think that you know, it's going to vary with different people as to what is going to motivate them to keep going and to keep working. And with some people, yes, they're going to want to have that more hands-on, direct connection of the sense that I'm being compassionate to the people around me. And for other people, that isn't that important. And they perhaps, you know, some people would say they are more coldly rational, though I don't really like that language because I think they still are moved by the plight of people suffering. But they just say, look, it just makes sense to me that if I can do more good helping people far away who I never see, and if that means that I don't support those who are close to me to the same extent, I still think it makes sense for me to do more good. So they may continue to do that, and I know people like this, without feeling this, the kind of compassionate, loving kindness, whatever you know, somebody like Matthew Ricard, however they would put it. But I don't think actually we're very far apart. I was taking part in an event in Paris with Matthew Ricard only the week before last about animal questions, about the treatment of animals. And we had a conversation in which, you know, he certainly talks about empathy, but he talks about cognitive empathy. So it's empathy which helps us in understanding what things are like for other people. And that's not that far from what I'm talking about.
I'm going to do something really cheeky now, Peter, which is entirely kind of below the intellectual level you've established, which is a bit of audience participation. I'm going to give you three choices. You have to vote. You have to vote. Are you more inclined to be altruistic as a consequence of the last hour? Are you less inclined to be altruistic, or was your altruism already in the right position? You have to vote. Just do that for me. That's your altruistic act for me, is to vote. So all those who are inclined to be more altruistic as a consequence of the last hour, put your hand up. Okay, all those inclined to be less altruistic. Oh. It's a very small minority. And those whose altruism level is just about right anyway. Okay, so broadly speaking, you've done more good than harm. But
it's a fairly self-satisfied
bunch. Thank you. So if you want your self-satisfaction to be disrupted further, I would strongly encourage you to get Peter's excellent book, which is really overwhelmingly a kind of debate with all the kind of arguments that have been playing around your head that you didn't get a chance to ask. There's 101 other objections to Peter's arguments. He deals with them all brilliantly in his book. I encourage you to get it, and I'm sure, Peter, you don't mind signing it. Thank you for your excellent questions. Most of all, can I ask you to join me in thanking Peter Singer.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.